In episode 12 of season 6, I talked about how to create a healthy, diverse homeschool community. Thanks for the enthusiastic reception that you gave to that podcast. I had a follow-up question from one of our listeners. She talked about leaving a community after having invested and feeling bonded to the families, but the differences that arose between her family and the standards of this co-op made the departure inevitable. How can you make that transition seamlessly, perhaps without trauma to the kids or the friendships? And unfortunately, my answer is not a panacea or a magic bullet. Any kind of breakup is painful. I've been through them in my marriage. I've been through breakups with friends. This is a breakup. Leaving a group that was a source of support and kindness and gave your children friendships, leaving because you are no longer qualified to be there, because something about you is perceived as dangerous, makes it very difficult to sustain those relationships. Now, you may be able to find one or two families from that group that choose to stay in it, but still want you as a friend, and you can make a case-by-case evaluation. The bottom line is, when we have to break up, there is pain, there is a time of healing, and then there is a moment where you make peace and you can really move on. The timetable for that will differ based on the family and just how painful the separation is. I recommend, if possible, finding new people that are for you. If there is another group locally that has standards that allow you to join, that can be a really healthy way to move on. If, however, that doesn't exist, it may fall to you to build a new community, maybe for misfits, people who haven't been able to find what they're looking for in your city. And of course, you are always welcome in our community, the Brave Learner Home. You are listening to A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. I'm Julie Bogart, your host. I'm a veteran home educator of 5 kids. I have a book out called The Brave Learner. I run Brave Writer, which is an international writing and language arts program, both downloadable materials and online classes. And we have our brand new community for homeschoolers called The Brave Learner Home. All those things can be discovered on our website at bravewriter.com. But that is not why we're here today. Today, I want to talk to you about creativity in teaching, in educating, in leading learning in your family. So let's get started. Are you one of those people who thinks to yourself, well, it's all well and good, these natural learning models, but I'm just not creative. I am more of a bookish person. I'm more of a logistical organizing person. I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I'm not someone who sews or dances or sings or throws pots, right? We tend to think of creativity as meaning something in the arts or something that is crafted, you know, handicrafts. We're thinking of even things like cooking or woodworking, maybe even gardening. There's a certain belief that creativity attaches itself to imagination. And when we hear the word imagination, we're immediately thrust into the world of storytelling. It's really hard for us to sort of harness a different definition to the words creativity and imagination. And yet that is just what I'm going to do right now. When you think about the word creative, I want you to think about the root verb create. We're talking about the act of creating and doing it in sort of a habitual way. She is creative, creating. Creation happens around this person. That's what creative means. But creation is not limited to the arts. Literally anyone who's worked in a scientific lab will tell you it is a place filled with creativity. It is a place of big imaginations. It takes a mind open to possibility to create. So to give you a very mundane example that many of you, my listeners, will have experienced, you're in your kitchen, you're making dinner, you've got the recipe on the counter, and you suddenly reach for that can of tomato paste and you don't have it. So in your brain, the brain of you who has spent thousands of hours in your kitchen with your pantry, working with ingredients to make tasty meals, you must be what? Creative. You have to think, what can I substitute for the tomato paste? Am I going to throw in some ketchup, or am I going to grate some tomatoes and boil them down? Am I going to change the recipe completely and not make it a tomato-based experience? These are your moments of bringing your imagination to bear to problem solve. So creativity, in the way we're going to talk about it today, is that capacity to generate a new idea, to take the resources you've been given and to use them, exploit them, enjoy them, employ them in a fresh way. I told you we would also redefine imagination. So when I think of imagination, I might think Peter Pan, Never Never Land. I might think of someone as creative as J.K. Rowling. I might think it's about storytelling or dress-up clothes, but imagination is simply the capacity to picture in your mind what isn't, as though it is. To picture in your mind what isn't, as though it is. So in this arena of creativity, then, we are asking you to use your imagination to bring into reality something that doesn't currently exist. Now, it will be built from reality. I'm not asking you to do hocus pocus magic and create ex nihilo. That's not what we're doing. We're talking about, how do I envision what isn't into being so that it is? And in this case, the main reason to use the tool of creativity and imagination in teaching, in leading the learning experience in your home, is to bring into being a vehicle for learning that did not exist before. So when you're smacking into the brick wall of a child's struggle or resistance or tedium, creativity and imagination are your best friends. These are the tools. They're going to bail your whole family out. It's not going to be that you spend more time creating more disciplinary measures. We're going to talk about, how do you bring a new, refreshed point of view to the learning that you're asking for from your kids? So I have five processes that feed creativity and teaching, and we're going to get to those in just a moment. Before I give you those five steps or five containers that help you build a creative teaching life, let's address the elephant in the room. Some of you don't come from the arts or even empowered to believe you're a creative person. You might be more of a systems person where you can set up a schedule and organize the household in a logical way. You might be the kind of person who follows a plan, especially a plan someone else gives you, and you execute all day long, really clearly, with a lot of energy and alacrity. Maybe you're the kind of person who hears the word creativity and you sort of shudder at the mess it represents, either the physical, literal mess, you know, googly eyes and glue sticks all over your counters, or the figurative mess. Starting down the path with a good idea and watching it flail and then wither and die right in front of you, which of course is the fate of many creative projects. So for those of you who heard the title of this podcast and thought, It doesn't apply to me. And then you tuned in anyway. Brava to you. I'm impressed because sometimes the people who need to tap into their creativity the most are those who don't even realize that they have it. So let me paint a picture for you of what creativity looks like in the non-artistic version of being creative. So if you were in my office right now, what you would see is piles of books and papers and file folders sort of arranged chaotically on the floor. And there's a reason for this. I do not know how to creative problem solve paper, paraphernalia. I have books on my shelf like The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. I have Essentialism. I have books like Atomic Habits that are all aimed at helping me manage this mess. And yet, repeatedly, I do not manage the mess. And the reason for that is my creativity fails me at the level of organization. I am not creative in terms of organizational strategy. I am a rule follower at that level because I haven't flexed those muscles. So here's what happens. I invite over a friend who really loves home design and setting up offices. And that person walks in and what does she see? She sees an opportunity to exercise her creativity. She is going to find homes for all these papers. She's going to figure out a way to catalog what I have on the floor visible where I need it. She's going to find a way to catalog it so that it's easy for me to access and I won't forget the system. Creativity in terms of logistics is essential. We custom design systems and methods to stay on top of our logistical selves, right? That's why we buy these books. Creative people thought of those systems or can address your unique needs and give you a tailor-made version. Another kind of creativity has to do with interpersonal dynamics. So you run into the brick wall of a child's resistance, and you're the kind of person who has busied herself studying temperaments and has always been fascinated by the interplay of two people, their human dynamics. So your child comes along with resistance and your brain goes into creative problem solving from a temperament perspective. You're thinking, I know what this personality needs. And suddenly a whole lexicon of ideas occurs to you that either appease or manage or trigger and inspire this person. You know how to create connection and you have creative means for doing that regularly. These are all ways that people's creativity shows up. Another one is creativity in the STEM subjects. Some people look at a math sheet and have 10 ideas for how to do those math problems differently. I, by the way, have one. I know one way. I can teach you it one way, and then I'm out of ideas. So creativity does not only cluster around the arts or performance or what you might consider sort of the humanities. That tends to be our vision of it, but that is not its limit by any stretch. So when we talk about creativity in teaching, the first place we want to start is by recognizing what we're good at. What are you good at? What is the thing that you give yourself permission to do when you have free time? No surprise to all of you, I write. Endlessly writing. I'm writing emails. I'm writing books. I'm writing articles. I'm writing captions for posts. I'm writing podcasts. I write and I write and I write until it's exhausting to even think about it. What that means, however, is when I am spending time with children, my creativity around writing runs deep. It is available to me. Why? Because it is where I exercise that muscle the most frequently in my own life. So I want you to think for a moment, What is the muscle you exercise the most that gives you a sense of purpose and pleasure and performance? I'm thinking of many Instagram accounts I follow where moms really enjoy showcasing their system of organization around school materials and the cubbies for each student and the way they organize their pencils and their pens and all the materials that go with homeschooling. There's a certain knack for giving everyone the pleasure of always knowing where their things are, how to access them, how to use them. So let's talk about that parent. We're thinking now creatively about teaching. When that parent is up against a brick wall of a child's resistance, perhaps one of the places that you can draw on is the way you can create a pleasing, well-organized space for that child's mind to be liberated to focus on the task at hand. That was my mother's gift. She was not necessarily drumming up new ideas for us, but she had a way of always setting the stage that made the space very inviting, which allowed me the freedom to create for myself. So if you're thinking about creativity, then tap in right now, just in your mind, to a place where you feel free and successful at imagining new possibilities. I'll give you a moment, take a little musical interlude for that break. Think about it. Good. You got it? All right. So what we're going to do now is think about your expertise in creativity, whether that's the STEM subjects, logistics, cooking, being a connecty, relational person, or the arts. Any of those are places where you are already rich with the source material of creativity that could liberate your teaching with your children. So there are five categories of, or stages maybe, of creativity that we're going to walk through now. And I'm going to tell you each one. So the first one is saturation. There is no creativity without saturation. What do I mean by that? Those ball players in professional sports that are labeled creative athletes are those who are so skilled, so deep in the sport that their bodies and their minds can imagine new ways to approach the same shot or the same pass or the same putt. They are bringing with them a well of experience. They have saturated so thoroughly in that sport that many, many more possibilities are available to their bodies than an amateur athlete. Another example. You're the kind of person who grows indoor houseplants beautifully. When a plant gets sick, you have many more ideas of how to rescue that plant's life and bring it back to full health than the rest of us who just throw it away and buy a new houseplant, right? Your creativity will kick into gear. You will think thoughts and have ideas and solutions available to you that do not come to other people. So the first step in creative teaching is saturating. So let's say you're like me and you happen to be good at writing, and writing is the source of your greatest creativity. And you're looking at a child who is struggling, not with writing, but with math, and you are limited in your math background. You have two options. The first one is to use your creativity in writing, in your strength, as a hack for math. So in my family, it kind of looked like this. I used to jot down my kids narrating math processes. At one point, Johanna had a 3x5 card file filled with the processes narrated by her that she could page through and read anytime she got stuck in a math problem. We co-created them through a jot it down method using writing to help her with math. Another example, when Noah was working on times tables, I showed him how to write times tables, how to create his own table, where to put the numbers, because written expressions of math were easier for me to teach. They were more easy for me to convey the information. And eventually Noah got very obsessed with creating times tables to the point where he was doing different bases, like base 2 or base 12, and running them through that same grid. Another way that we've used writing to teach another subject, to use the creative well of my writing depth to jog somebody free. When my kids were working on science, we made lap books, or we wrote out the nature journal and drew and added captions, because so much of our family culture was built from this saturation in the written word. So we used it almost like as a can opener to help unpack other subjects. Saturation is essential. So the first principle then is take advantage of that area that you are already naturally saturated in and use it as a creative tool to help you in the subjects that are weaker. So let's say you're really good at math. Could you create timelines for history? Could you do some quantities and combinations of, you know, numbers of years or numbers of weeks or numbers of tanks, and start to think geographically and space and time, as opposed to just what I always do, which is more thematic, because that's my bent. So you're going to use your area of expertise as a creative can opener for the subject where you're feeling impaired. But the other way to use saturation is to literally saturate yourself in the subject that is uncomfortable and unfamiliar to you. And you get to do that. You're home learning. You can learn alongside your kids. So this happens for a lot of parents teaching their kids grammar. They don't remember grammar from when they were kids. And maybe it's difficult to think about how to teach grammar using math or science as your background. Although immediately I thought of three ways to do that just sitting here. I'll share those in a minute. But what you could do is become curious about grammar for yourself. Instead of just trusting the dusty textbook that nobody wants to open and that you find tedious as well, go online, find some adult books like Eats, Shoots, and Leaves or Woe Is I, and read about grammar in a much more consumer-friendly way. Go look up Grammar Girl online and start reading the way Grammar Girl talks about common grammar tropes. All right, let's circle back then to how you might bring a STEM sensibility to the study of grammar in English, because I know that's niggling away in your brain and you're waiting for it. Here's what I'm talking about. You can look at a subject that's a little bit opaque or difficult or tedious for you or your kids, and think through how you might approach it using a completely different subject as the can opener. In this case, science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. So let's look a little bit at science, technology, and math related to grammar. So the first step might be open a Google spreadsheet, you know, Google Sheet or an Excel spreadsheet, and Google the top 100 words that English speakers use on a regular basis. So these would be the most frequently used terms in the English language. You could do a smaller sample if you wanted, but 100 is a nice number. And then populate that spreadsheet by number of letters in the word. Then make another column and do the same thing by number of syllables. Compare and contrast those. Are some words really long with one syllable and some words really short with two syllables? That might be a fun place to start. Then I want you to look at those words and talk with your kids about which part of speech goes with the terms, and take a look to see which part of speech has the shortest words and which part of speech has the longest words. Which one has the fewest syllables? Which one has the most syllables? And then make some theories, some guesses. Why do you think that is? Your kids are going to come with hypotheses that you can't even think of right now. because you've been raised in English, you've lived a lot longer, and you're going to draw some conclusions based on all that experience. But the job isn't to get them to have your conclusion. It's to get them critically thinking, examining all of this data, and then making up stuff, making up theories, hypotheses, guesswork, because that's what leads to curiosity and learning. It's triggering your interest. I have this data. What does it mean? What can I do with it? So that's a beginning level of looking at grammar. You could then look up the next 100 words that are most commonly used and ask a really good question before you do it. Ask a question like, do you think the average number of letters in a word in the next 100 is going to be greater than the average number of letters in the words of the first 100? Or do you think it'll be fewer? You can ask the same thing about syllables. You might even classify the first 100 words by noun, verb, preposition, article, adjective, adverb, like that. You might make columns in the spreadsheet and resort everything into those columns and then quantify and make a bar graph or a pie chart. Or you could just do it in a drawing, right? I mean, you could use the tools that Excel gives you, or you could do it in a drawing and actually use the tools of measurement to make sure that your bar graph and your circle, your pie circle split up into the various amounts is accurate. Suddenly you're using math to analyze the data you gathered from your science experiment about grammar. And you're doing it using technology and hand notation and collection. So you could quantify all that information, how many articles, how many nouns, how many adverbs in the top 100, and then do the same thing for the second 100. And now ask yourself, how many nouns, how many articles? Does the proportion, the ratio of nouns and adjectives and adverbs and prepositional phrases, does that change in the second 100 most commonly used words by human beings who speak English? As you can see, suddenly the study of grammar is an adventure. It's not just this tedium of, well, you have to learn it. You better get through it. I think so often when we're pitting school against unschool, the block for us in unschool is not realizing that the hardest part of the job is the creativity in teaching. So we want to go back to what's steady, safe, secure, easy to execute when you have 6 children underfoot. And I get that. That's why I say only do this with one subject a month. You might have to just go on cruise control for some of those subjects that you can't invest this level of creativity in. But when you have a student who is resistant or a subject that is opaque to you, that's the one that you tune into and bring your skill set to bear on that subject. Okay, the second idea I had was to explore word origins. Now, a lot of us have used things like Rummy Roots, or you've studied Latin and Greek roots, and so you have passing familiarity. Any child who's read Harry Potter has encountered spells in Latin. Latin and Greek are not necessarily subjects you have to study in order to value them in the English language. But what we usually do is we start from the wrong end of the telescope. We start with English, and then we assign them Latin or Greek roots. And because Latin and Greek are not familiar to many students, now, you classical educators who are learning Latin, this is irrelevant to you. But for the rest of us, Latin and Greek are sort of opaque. It doesn't mean anything to read the word anthropos. We don't know why we should care about that that's related to anthropology. So flip the telescope around. Start with the Greek or Latin word. In fact, what you could do one night after the kids are in bed is create a whole stack of post-it notes with the most common Greek and Latin roots that are found in the English language. You could make them colorful, or you could just be like me, lazy, and use a pencil. But you could put them on note cards or post-it notes all over the kitchen table while your kids sleep. And when they wake up in the morning and it's time to eat their Cheerios, they're going to look at the table and say, what are these? say, I don't know. Can you figure out what any of these mean? Well, I don't recognize them. I don't know these words. Well, do they look similar to any words you know? I'm going to be making breakfast and tea over here, and I have a podcast to listen to, but there are whiteboard markers on the table. See how many words you can think of that might relate to these weird looking words sitting on the table, and then leave them to it. Let them classify and sort and figure out if they need a chart in order to organize them. Or maybe they'll just do them in a random chaotic list on the whiteboard. And then you can show them how to bring some order, how to cluster, how to make a spreadsheet that catalogs that. Then you can spend the rest of the month hunting for more related words in the wild. Every time they stumble across one, hear one on a TV show, notice one in an online game, they add it to the collection in the spreadsheet. This turns grammar into a journey, into an adventure, not just something to get through and get done. And here's what I can promise you. These correlations that they will start making will have a weird kind of meaning for them. Maybe not your intended meaning, but there will become a sort of vocabulary of what grammar means to them that is forming inside. Not what grammar is, but what it means to them. That's the goal in education. Okay, and then the third idea I had, which still falls into this sort of detective, classification, hypotheses, guesswork, spreadsheet, math. I don't really have engineering. I will leave that to you software developers to think about what to do for that. What if you focus on pronunciation? English has so many weird spellings that are difficult to detect when you're first learning to read how to say them. You know, tough, through, though, they all use O-U-G-H. And then the G-H itself is just fascinating. It has such an amazing history. I mean, we've got ghost, ought, daughter. We have through. These are all different ways that we use the G-H sound, cough. I mean, what is going on with that combo? Could we do a little rabbit trail hunt? And if you do, by the way, I'll just let you know, the people who use the old English version of words get very guttural and it starts becoming really fun. You start saying in your family, cough, you know, go listen to the Canterbury Tales read in their original form. I still remember the opening lines. It's, when on April with the sure sutta, the drucht of March hath pierced to the rutta. Okay, now if you looked at those words, you could say them the way Americans say them now. You wouldn't necessarily understand them, but that's not how they used to be pronounced. So could you ask the question, why do you think pronunciation has changed so much over time? And then you could look up and see if you were right. And then you could start collecting weird spellings and discussing those pronunciations. And guess what? We just threw history into the bargain. So now we're doing STEM, we're doing grammar, and we're doing history. Creativity in teaching looks like that. And guess what? It'll take up your whole morning and you will never get to the math worksheet that day. Oh, well. That's okay. You're making Venn diagrams right now. How many words serve both noun and verb? Oh my goodness, wouldn't that be amazing to make a Venn diagram of all the words that can be nouns and verbs? Or to verbalize any of those nouns that aren't currently verbs and start using them in your family and see what that feels like, how that heightens the magic in language. Okay, you can tell I love words. But that was my example, and I hope it helps you just shift the energy around what it means to be creative in teaching. So now we're going to take a moment to hear a little bit about a Brave Writer product line that I think will help you in this creativity piece, and then we'll come back for the rest of the podcast. In keeping with today's topic for the podcast, I thought I would use the ad portion of this podcast to talk to you about our writing programs called Jot It Down, Partnership Writing, and Faltering Ownership. These are three programs that are filled with 10 and 12 writing projects. What do I mean by a writing project? Well, a lot of times in school, we call these writing assignments. But assignments often carry with them some kind of rigid criteria. They most often follow what looks more like an academic form, like a report or an essay or a series of paragraphs. But that's not what we've created in our three programs. These writing projects programs are definitely teaching all the skills your kids need for those academic formats, but we get at them creatively. I have used my writing brain to bring to you new, fresh ways to teach the same old stuff. So instead of talking about how to write a narrative book report, we are going to teach you how to make a dust jacket for your favorite book and do an author bio and a book review on the jacket cover after you've designed it. It's going to include reviews from people like Darth Vader or your best friend on the back. It will include a spine and a cover design. This is the way that we start to play with the forms to bring them more meaning for the stage of growth that your child is in. Rather than just making a list of adjectives that describe on a sheet of paper, in the jot it down level, we have children lay down on the ground. We draw around them on butcher paper with a marker and we cut it out. And then you go on an adjective hunt with your child for words that describe that child that you can glue stick in creative design ways on an image of their own body and hang it on their door so that they can see it every day and start to get to know how language relates to who they are. We have an opportunity to make a homonym book where it's got visual images as well as the words. There is a project in partnership writing that is all about making a mail order catalog for a historical period in time. In our family, we made one called the Mesopotamia Mall, and it sold all kinds of embalming tools and herbs, etc., from ancient Egypt. The point is this: if you are feeling a little stuck in your creativity around writing, this is like a can opener that we provide you. I've put my brain behind these activities to give you a jump start so that you can then harness these activities and tailor make them to your children and whatever else you're studying in your homeschool currently. So I commend to you Jot It Down for 5 to 8 year olds, partnership writing for 9 and 10 year olds, and faltering ownership for 11 and 12 year olds. These three programs will give you the kind of creativity and imagination around writing that right now might not be as readily available to you. And I have a hunch once you've saturated and incubated a bit inside these programs, you will be triggered with new creative ways to use writing in your child's homeschool. You can learn more about these products by going to store.bravewriter.com and clicking on Writing Projects. Store.bravewriter.com. Click on the box that says Writing Projects. Can't wait for you to experience them. And I'd love to see your images of the writing projects you do with your kids on Instagram. You can follow me at Julie Brave Writer and use the hashtag Brave Writer Lifestyle. All right, let's get back to our topic today. You might purchase Nitty Gritty Grammar or More Nitty Gritty Grammar. Those are the two books I recommend by Edith Fine and Judith Josephson. These use syndicated cartoons to teach grammar concepts. What I'm saying is this: when you are wanting to be creative, you cannot do it from a vacuum. And so when you say to me or say to yourself, oh, I can't do anything but follow the lesson plan because I'm not a creative person, what that tells me is this: you have not yet invested the time to saturate in the problem, the lesson or subject you're trying to teach. You have not sort of wallowed in its complexity and then imagined either using the resource of your skill where your creativity is more natural to you, or having wallowed in the subject itself enough to start to see its contours, to feel its vibration, so that you could be creative. And trust me, it's possible with subjects you don't know really well. Just reading the program, giving yourself time to read the teacher's notes, to try a few of the problems, to see if you can perform at a compelling and excellent level before you expect that of your children, your creativity will kick in. Let's say you're working through a grammar workbook and it's pretty challenging for your kids and they hate it and they're bored. What would happen if you dedicated an afternoon, you Xerox photocopy several of the pages, and you try to do the answers, perform at the level the program's asking your child to, and discovering why it's irksome, what's challenging about it, what do you not remember that you're amazed you don't remember, and yet you expect your fourth grader to know? This is what I mean by saturation. You want to sit with the problem and avail yourself of your area of creative skill, or become much more intimately acquainted with the subject you're trying to bring to life for your child. So number one is saturate, and the length of time will vary person to person. When people enter the Brave Writer space, that's what I'm really hoping will happen with writing, that you will saturate in the principles of this healthy writing life. That's what the writer's jungle is. It is me conveying to you what it takes to have a writing life, and it gives you creative tools to jumpstart that experience for your children. I am drawing on my background in the professional world of writing to shortcut that for you so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. That's saturation. Go read, go wallow, go reflect. Get sort of comfy, cozy like you're in a jacuzzi before you foist the challenging thing on your child. Number two, incubate. Once you have saturated, give yourself a little window of time to imagine possibilities. Here's where your imagination kicks in. What would it be like for my child to know all her times tables? What would it be like for my child to be able to diagram a sentence? What would it be like for my child to enjoy history? You start to give yourself permission to think about the outcome that you want to see in your child's educational experience. And you now have to think, what actually gets me there? We can use reward and punishment. Carrot and stick learning is pretty common still in schools. But the better teachers, the ones that win Teacher of the Year, the parents that are looked back at fondly by their homeschooled graduates, these are the people who found a way to make the subject meaningful. And it almost always involves some kind of creative risk or surprise or mystery or adventure. It just does, because those are the things that stick with us long term. So if you are imagining in this incubation stage, you can draw things on post-it notes. You can make a mind map on a sheet of paper. You can audio record yourself free, you know, sort of stream of consciousness, freely creating ideas. Give yourself, after you've saturated, maybe a week where each day you kind of play with an idea in your mind. You can continue the status quo of begrudging learning. That's fine. But while you're doing that, allow yourself to start thinking, maybe there's something I haven't considered. Could I teach these same math concepts with a deck of cards? Could we cover this same period of history, but do it with a different book series? Could we throw a party to celebrate this period of history as opposed to just studying it? Starting to give yourself permission to imagine another way. So saturate, incubate. And then the third concept is leap of faith. Now you gotta do it. So the idea comes to you. And let me just clarify, The ideas almost always come as a bolt of lightning. They don't come fully formed, and they definitely don't come fully resourced. You will have saturated and incubated, and one day in the middle of the afternoon, you'll suddenly see it. Oh my gosh, I forgot I have an outfit I wore in high school in theater that is from this historical period. That might jumpstart dress-up clothes play for this historical period. I'm going to go get it. It's a leap of faith. Oh my goodness, the kids are all playing and they keep putting on hats. I've got this great book, Caps for Sale. I'm going to read it to them and see if they want to act it out. That can be their narration for Caps for Sale. Oh goodness, we're out taking a hike. We're going to color our pictures and write down what we see in nature. But I just remembered haiku is a poetry form for nature. Wonder if I can teach them a haiku while we're sitting out next to the creek. That would be fun. These are the leaps of faith moments that come to you after saturation and after incubation. When parents are seen as highly creative, what it means is you're only seeing the end result of hours of flipping through magazines and thinking about these ideas. Some of you are expert house decorators and your friends look at you in awe. They think, how did she know to do that? Oh, I would never have taken that risk with paint. How did she know to do that? Well, here's what I know. My good friend Dottie, who I talk about in The Brave Learner, is that kind of decorator. I have never been to her house when she hasn't had several books on home decorating on the coffee table. She goes to the library, checks out a slew of them, and over coffee, pages through, feeding her imagination with looks and ideas that then when she implements them, they look spontaneous. They look spontaneous combustion level creativity. That's what I'm talking about. The leap of faith comes once you have sufficiently saturated in the material, incubated to give yourself time to have ideas, to imagine possibilities, and then bam, you're going to have that moment and you need to take the leap right then. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Leap into your idea. Set aside everything else. Sort of like those sitcoms when two characters are about to have a big makeout scene and, you know, the girl or the guy takes her arm and just sweeps the coffee table or the kitchen table. That's what I'm talking about. Just clear the space to indulge the idea. Now, many of these ideas have come to me over the years, and I'm going to give you some examples of things we did in my family, not meant as sort of a template to copy. Although if you are inspired by what I share, by all means, feel free to copy what we did. But what I want you to catch isn't so much the content, but the way the ideas came to me. Okay? So we'll do that after we get through these 5 points, these 5 principles. So the first one was saturate. The second one was incubate. The third one is leap of faith. When the lightning bolt comes, dive in. Now, will you have all the tools and resources? You will not. Will you have to improvise just like when you ran out of tomato paste for the dinner? Yeah. But here's the good news. You're at home and you know what you have and you can improvise. In fact, if you had to, you could throw everyone in the car, put on their masks if you live in Ohio, and go into Target and buy that glue gun if you needed it. Or you can do Amazon Prime and get it in 2 days and put off your leap of faith moment till you have the key ingredient. But the bottom line is this, whether or not you have everything is not a reason to delay. You want to trust that when the instinct hits, you're going to chase it a little bit. And here's the reason why. I call this action Aunt Lady Inspiration. She's your fun aunt. And if you ignore her when she finally visits you after you've saturated and incubated, She won't return if you keep ignoring her ideas. And pretty soon you return to sort of this deadened version of your amazing self. So what I'm trying to do is wake up that creative person that I know is inside you. So number four then is activate. So you've taken the leap of faith. You're going to follow through on your good hunch. And now you're going to activate. You're going to get busy gathering supplies or reading your idea to your kids or modeling the activity or joining in or supplying them with the technology they need. You know, I remember at one point, long before podcasting, in fact, two of my kids created their own radio show using whatever it was back then, some version of GarageBand on my computer. And what's so amazing to me now is that came because they had been listening to these YouTube people talking about Harry Potter, almost like a radio show. So they created their own. And that's what we're talking about. When the idea came, it was sort of a gestalt moment. And I gave them the tools they needed. And they spent just so many fun hours creating this, what they called interesting conversations with Jacob and Katrin. I still have it on my computer. Jacob's voice hadn't even changed yet. He was still that young. That's what we're talking about. Activate. Give them the tools they need. Do not delay. When a child comes to you and says, "Mom, I've got an idea," that's the time to activate it. And activation means getting in gear with them, helping them have the resources they need. Now, I understand if you're working from home and they come to you in the middle of a business meeting, you can't drop the meeting and activate then. But when you finish that business meeting, the first order of business with your child ought to be that idea. Give it its head, support it, activate it. If you are invited to participate, and that's an honor, if you are, do it. Because by being a part of what they're creating or you helping them create it, you are now modeling learning. You are a part of the journey of internalizing these principles that you're hoping they'll learn rather than just checking them off a list to prove you've covered them. And those are two very different experiences. Covering a subject versus learning a subject, not the same thing. So the last thing you're going to do then, number five, is evaluate. So saturate, incubate, take a leap of faith, activate, evaluate. Evaluation is an opportunity for you to sort of reflect and record what happened. What happened? So your child came to you and said, "I want to make with Sculpey clay that you bake, miniature homes for these tiny little paper doll people I created." And so now she's creating, you know, the Kleenex box and the sofa and the coffee table. And you're looking at that and you're thinking, well, was that learning? But yes, it is. It's dexterity. It is imagining a design and executing it. It's figuring out proportions based on the doll models. It's using color. It's living a dream story in the imagination while you're building the home to support that narrative. Could you go back to that child and say, "Tell me the story of what's happening in this little house that you created," and you jot that down? I'm thinking of another example. I remember when Dottie and I lived across from each other in our two condos in California. She had just returned from the farmer's market with her three kids. When we came over to see if they were ready to play, the three kids were all making birdhouses out of fruit and vegetable crates. Apparently, while they were at the farmer's market, Dottie eyed one of the stands where a woman was selling these cute birdhouses she had constructed out of these little wooden crates used for vegetables and fruit. And there was a sign saying that there would be a contest and anyone could enter it. Now, this was an adult woman, offering an adult contest, purportedly, to create birdhouses out of food crates. But Dottie, being the creative, artistic person she is, saw it as an opportunity for her children to create those birdhouses. And sure enough, there they were with a drill and a saw and hammers and nails and glue guns and all these interesting little doodads that they were gluing to the outside to make it charming. And they were putting little signs. And they went back, and not many people entered this contest. So her family won. This was like a week later. And you think to yourself, how is that related to anything? But it's related to everything. This is an opportunity for kids to enter a contest, to use a lot of tools, to envision a design and execute it, for them to share resources with each other and celebrate one another's accomplishments. These are not small lessons. They are the heart and soul of what it means to be a full person and well-educated. So at the end of that experience, Dottie could evaluate that and quantify what parts of her education she was hoping to give her kids it counted for. Art, design, competition, execution of design. I mean, I think it's just fabulous. Relating to the rules of the competition and applying them, so good. I remember too, one morning, getting in a conversation with my kids over cereal boxes. And we spent the next half hour before the internet discussing all the different ingredients inside the cereal box. And then the next time we were at the library, I found a book that helped us look those ideas up, those words, to understand what is maltodextrose and, you know, coconut and palm oil. What are these things and how do we digest them? When you are in a learning moment and you are saturated and you have incubated, when the moment comes, take the leap of faith, activate by using your resources that you have available, and later do the evaluating. See how it fits in with the education you're giving your kids. Now, a lot of parents tell me when we're talking about creativity that they're just not good at it. So I want to address some of the barriers to creative learning, and then I will give you some examples of being a creative teacher in my own family. So one of the barriers is seeing creativity as artistic or performance-based, which we already talked about. Just discard that. Everything you do is creative, from deciding which route to take to the grocery store to what to name your next baby. You are constantly engaged in the process of tapping into your own ability to cast vision and to follow through. So well done you, you're already creative. The second barrier is getting these five steps out of order. What typically happens is we get a random idea. We don't realize it's coming from the best source of us, the saturation and the incubation. We think it came out of left field. We don't realize that the saturating and incubating were secretly rearranging themselves into fully developed ideas or even partially developed ideas that will bob to the surface to get our attention. So we evaluate before we take the leap. That's a mistake. If you go to evaluation before execution, you will never benefit from your creativity. It's probably a strong statement. You might benefit from it. But my point is this. When we evaluate prematurely, like, is this a good idea? No, it's dumb. Or we can't do that. We don't have the ingredients. Or I hate science, so I don't want to do that idea. When we do that, we short circuit the opportunity for surprise, mystery, risk, and adventure, the four enchanting principles of learning. So give yourself permission to not evaluate, to take a leap of faith. The third barrier to being a creative teacher is exaggerating the impact of a failed experiment. So first of all, you have to know if you take creative risks, you're going to get some big bloopers. Kids who didn't like it, a project that fell apart after you spent all that time gluing it together, an experiment whose result was a dud, children who started with a lot of enthusiasm and then wilted under the pressure to complete such a big project. These are all learning experiences. Even if you only do part of a vision, you have done the leap of faith. And that's where evaluation comes in. You can look at it and realize, okay, you know, we really can't do that project without a glue gun. All the other glues we have will not accomplish it. Good to know. No, we really can't dig up the entire backyard and build a little Disneyland miniature world. That's too big of a project. We can do it in a 2x4 section of the yard. Sometimes these brainstorms are just overpowered or overblown because you haven't gotten good at practicing the creative impulse. So just know that the failure is never big. It just is. The quote-unquote failure of a project is just a learning moment. You know, Thomas Edison and the 1,000 trials. It's one of those. And you have permission to take creative leaps of faith that are non-productive, that go nowhere, that do not accomplish your original goal. Okay? In fact, when it happens, put it on a hash mark somewhere, like on a whiteboard, and give yourself credit every time you have 10 failed leaps of faith. And then buy yourself a latte or something and say, good for me. I am exercising my creativity muscle. I will keep getting better at it because I did 10. And 10 that didn't work means I'm closer to one that really will. And then the fourth barrier to being a creative teacher is the belief that you have to have all the right ingredients to start. And you really don't. Now, I will tell you this. If the kind of projects and creative ideas that come to you involve art supplies, do yourself a favor right now and stock up your cabinet for the whole year. Go buy pipe cleaners and glitter and googly eyes and tissue paper and construction paper. Go buy felt and embroidery floss and needles. Go buy those, yarn boards. They look like graph paper and they're plastic. Go get a box of popsicle sticks. Tons of glue guns. Get the little mini ones that aren't as hot and as many little glues as you can, the little cartridges that go in. Get the kind of glue that works for fabric. Buy the 12-pack of glue sticks. It's amazing how quickly those dry out when kids forget to put the lids on. Have washable markers, window markers, permanent markers. Get tempera paint, watercolor paints. Are you hearing me? Just stock up. So that when the idea comes to you, you don't say, drat, we used up the one glue stick last month because, you know, Tommy left it out on the counter without a cap. Just do yourself a favor, have 5 staplers. The best advice I got, and this is back when I was really poor and had 5 children, was buy the 10-pack of scissors because you're going to lose them all in a year. That's the idea. Duplicates help. So stock up now so that when a creative idea comes, you don't discount it for lack of supplies. Same thing goes when the creative idea isn't around the arts. Maybe you need stuff for planting or doing work in the yard, you know, more than one hoe so that more than one child can be a part of this experience. If you know what you tend toward, if your creativity shows up the most in baking and cooking, then have available tools that children can use, a good step stool so that you're not using your nice dining room chairs and they're getting holes in them because your kids drag the buckle of their shoe across the top of the vinyl. Create the conditions that allow for creativity to occur, and then don't worry if you don't have the supplies. Improvise with what you have. And if it's truly critical, for instance, maybe you need some science-y ingredient for your microscope and slide, the moment you have the leap of faith, go get it. Order it online, drive to Target, pop over to Kroger. Just take the initiative while the inspiration is present, because Here's what will happen. If you don't order the thing, the electrical circuit or whatever it is, by the afternoon, you will have evaluated it and decided it's not worth doing. That's why you have to act. When the bolt of lightning comes, that's the moment to take the leap of faith, whether it's ordering an ingredient or diving right in and clearing the table of everything else. So let me give you a few examples from my own life that might be fun for you to hear. So my kid's dad and I both had a huge love of Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is one of those opaque subjects for most people, but not for John and me. John had studied it in his master's degree. I had done theater in high school and had read Shakespeare. We were active in our local Shakespeare community here in Cincinnati. The company here allowed you to attend their performances for free if you were an usher. So John and I loved being ushers for Shakespeare. And we wanted our kids to have this experience of Shakespeare. So all the way back when we were in California, before we were even in Cincinnati, I realized a couple of things. One, Johanna needed some personal attention. She was the second child in a family of five kids. And because she was older, I too often relied on her to be sort of self-soothing and self-propelling because that's her kind of temperament. So one day I decided I would introduce Shakespeare to Johanna and I farmed out the other four kids. And the idea that came to me in a bolt of lightning was Johanna loves tea parties and our family loves tea. What if I created a tea party to read Shakespeare with her? And so that's just what we did. She put on a cute dress. We got out the tablecloth. I can still picture even the exact tablecloth, the candles. What she remembers is I let her have her own lemon yogurt. You know, we were in a family of seven with those big yogurt containers from Costco. But when we went to the store, I bought her her own little lemon yogurt cup. And we made some cookies or muffins or something and drank tea. And that was the genesis of Poetry Tea Time, that experience. The next week, I brought all the kids in and we just used poetry books. My point is this, I was seeking connection with Johanna and I wanted to see how it would go to teach Shakespeare to the kids, but I decided to start with just one child, not all five, and get a feel for how that would work. So that creative experience actually launched a practice we have continued to this day. They did all become fans of Shakespeare and acted in plays and have attended the plays, and they all love poetry. Because I took an initiative that even cleared the decks of my children. I didn't even do it with all five kids. Another one. I remember when we were shopping at this supermarket in Cincinnati called Jungle Jim's. It is known for its incredible array of produce that support cuisines from other countries, whether it's Asia or South America or Africa. So it's sort of a parade of nations every time you go there, just this gorgeous array of different cuisines represented in the foods, in the produce, and in the patrons. Well, when we would go to this store, it became a tradition for my kids to pick out some kind of fruit or vegetable that we did not know anything about to try it. And this came to me. Why? Well, because I've lived abroad and learning foreign languages and living abroad and getting to know other cultures was a huge part of our family tradition, our family culture. John had been in the Peace Corps. We had lived abroad together. And so while I'm rolling through Jungle Gyms, the idea hits me. It's not like I sat at home planning a unit study around cuisine from other countries. Instead, it's that I had spent so much time saturated in a love of other cultures, incubating about how to introduce my children to the world so they would be global citizens. And then there I was in the middle of a supermarket when the flash of insight came. And I remember us eating like pomelos and starfruit and dragon fruit because of that inspiration. It wasn't this lengthy lesson. We didn't go to the library and check out books and learn horticulture around these plants. We simply ate it and tasted it and associated it with its origin country. And that was it. But it brought energy, right? Like on a day when you go to the store and you come home with a dragon fruit, there's energy happening. There's an energy exchange. There's some excitement. And that actually fuels a willingness to do copy work or math afterward, because there's been a feeling of being involved in their learning in a way that they value. Another example, and this one is one of my flops. I thought you should have a good flop. So after 9/11, my kids who were young were sort of grappling with what they had seen and not really understanding it. They watched their mother and father burst into tears as the towers came down. And I want to just tell you, when that event occurred and we were watching it on TV in real time with our children, we did not know what we were about to witness. And as those towers fell, I crumbled to the couch and just wept. And their big, strong dad, 6'4" man, cried. And my children witnessed us having this powerful reaction. Two things we did, one success, one that was a flop. The next day, John let the kids know that there had been this attack and they believed it was from Muslims. And we had lived in a Muslim country and we knew that not all Muslims were terrorists. And so John and the kids and I went and got a box of donuts and we went to the mosque, which is just a couple miles from our house. And we brought donuts to the people who work there the day after 9/11. And we did that to let them know that we knew they weren't the terrorists and we knew they were about to go through a really hard season, right? So that was a spontaneous reaction built from our love of cultures, wanting to do something kind in our community as good citizens. But I didn't know how to help my kids process what they had just seen. So at some point during that week, we decided we would send letters to the first responders, just, you know, the firefighters and the police officers of New York. And my kids weren't really old enough to write letters fluently. So they decided to draw pictures. So here's where the flop comes in. Oh, they drew pictures, all right. They drew pictures of a plane crashing in a building. They drew pictures of buildings falling. They drew pictures of fire trucks and police officers and flames. I think Johanna's picture even has a person jumping out the window of one of the towers. We never mailed those pictures. As far as they know, they never got mailed. I did not realize that they were just needing a way to process what they had seen. They were picturing drawing these pictures and then mailing them off as comfort, I guess, to the police officers and the first responders. And that was an example of me sort of rooting around for a creative way to process this traumatic event that we went through in our country. And I wouldn't say it's a total failure. I think it achieved one of the goals, which was allowing them to show me what they were remembering, what they were taking away from it. But it was not successful all the way to the end. I did not put stamps on an envelope and mail those pictures to the police force and the firefighters in New York. So when you get these ideas, just realize that sometimes they have unintended consequences or outcomes. Oh my gosh, the number of science experiments we tried that flopped because I just was not skillful is ridiculous. And in fact, Jacob would say that one of the 55 things I didn't do that I failed at were these kitchen chemistry experiments. I kept not having the right ingredients and I kept trying to execute them and they did not live up to whatever the hype was in the books. I just did not have the skill. So not everything you try to saturate, incubate, leap of faith, activate, evaluate will work. But give yourself permission to experiment, to take a risk, to take that leap of faith and let your intuition, your imagination, your creativity lead you for a change. Don't relegate it to the after school hours where creativity only happens after we've been dutiful students and teachers in the morning. Let it interrupt you. Let it blindside you, take you by storm, surprise you, knock you off the plan. Some of the best experiences of our lives came from trusting the leap of faith. And I want to offer that to you as a viable way to grow in your skills as a creative teacher. If you are looking for more ideas and tools that will give you sort of the handholds you're looking for, of course, my book, The Brave Learner, is a great resource for that. You can pick it up at thebravelearner.com, or you can buy it on any, you know, website, independent bookstores, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. There is a free companion guide to walk you through some of these practices. Go to thebravelearner.com and you will find a downloadable copy free for you to print. It's also a great tool to use in book clubs. And you're free to print it for all your friends because it is literally free to print. It is not for resale, though. You may not sell it. Otherwise, I hope to see many of you in the Brave Learner home where we are continuing to grow in these practices. And I wish you the best as you kick off this new school year in the Northern Hemisphere, or as you are resuming after summer break or winter break, I guess it is, in the Southern Hemisphere. We look forward to partnering with you during August, September, October, and beyond. And I am happy to take more questions for this podcast. You can send them to help@bravewriter.com. Please put podcast topics in the subject line so that they get to me. Today's episode of the podcast has been brought to you and produced by Crate Media. I'm Julie Bogart from Brave Writer. Keep going. I'm rooting for you.